An honest witness tells the truth. A false witness tells lies. Only simpletons believe everything they're told. The prudent carefully consider their steps. The wise are cautious and avoid danger. Fools plunge ahead with reckless confidence. The Lord is watching everywhere, keeping his eye on both the evil and the good. Fire tests the purity of silver and gold, but the Lord tests the heart. Wrongdoers eagerly listen to gossip. Liars pay close attention to slander. The name of the Lord is a strong fortress. The godly run to him and are safe. The rich think of their wealth as a strong defense. They imagine it to be a high wall of safety. Haughtiness goes before destruction. Humility precedes honor. Spouting off before listening to the facts is both shameful and foolish. The first to speak in court sounds right until the cross-examination begins. Better to be poor and honest than to be dishonest and a fool. Enthusiasm without knowledge is no good. Haste makes mistakes. People ruin their lives by their own foolishness and then are angry at the Lord. Wealth makes many friends. Poverty drives them all away. A false witness will not go unpunished, nor will a liar escape. Though good advice lies deep within the heart, a person with understanding will draw it out. It is God's privilege to conceal things and the king's privilege to discover them. This is God's word.
And now may the words of my mouth and the meditation of our hearts be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, our rock and our redeemer. So if you've been with us for a while, you know wisdom literature is the theme for the year, the entire year. We often think of the Bible as kind of a book of answers. We go to want to clear things up. There are even little books that get sold called Bible answer books that try to make that even easier, where you go in there under your topic and there's the verse that gives you the answer. And Proverbs doesn't work like that. Wisdom literature does not function like that. And it presents us with things that can potentially seem clear, but its goal is to make you think and ask more questions and sometimes to muddy the waters for the sake of you growing as you work it out. So my first example is our first proverb of the evening. An honest witness tells the truth. A false witness tells lies. Is that the most obvious statement ever, right? Well, kind of. But if we were to sit around in a circle and say, okay, is that always how that works? Is it always true that that's how it works? Like, does a false witness ever tell the truth? Is that possible? Can a false witness avoid telling a lie under oath while still having the intent to promote a falsehood? If you work it well enough, can you avoid telling a lie while still having nefarious intent? And that brings up the bigger question of, like, what does it mean to lie? Is it just as simple as something that isn't factually true? Or could that include things that have malintent, that are deceptive, even if you couldn't technically pin it down as a lie, right? See, wisdom literature is meant to get you thinking about that. And then ideally, in a circle, people would go, you know what? I saw this one movie, or I was in a courtroom setting or something, you know? And I mean, I've been a juror. It's complicated. Wisdom literature is meant to instigate that dilemma and actually forms us through the process of wrestling with that. So it's messy. Statements can prove to be not so simple, like the one I just read. There are parallelisms where one thing is said and then another thing is said that makes you think about the first thing that was said. In the book of Proverbs, there are actually contradictory proverbs. One says one thing, one says the other. They seem like they're in opposition. And what you're supposed to do is wrestle with the two. It's meant to get you talking. It's meant to get you telling stories. It's meant to get you thinking, which is why this week I'm going to tie in our movie night, which means about 10 of us are ahead right now. Yeah, don't you feel good about yourselves, all of you who went to movie night and are ahead of the curve. So we watched the new Knives Out, newest Knives Out, Wake Up Dead Man. And the movie clearly is speaking to some degree to our time. In this film, which is not a, it's not a Christian film, although there's a ton of themes around the church in it. But in the film, the pulpit, which is a giant pulpit that looks like a ship, and a pastor's personality and social media via a guy who's always got his phone out streaming things to YouTube. They all come to play in a movie that's begging the question, in a way, what is the church supposed to be about? In the film, there's a missing cross back there on the wall inside of the church. And that cross seems to be a metaphor or a symbol of what's been lost inside of this church. And there's a narrative about why it's not there, about a corrupt girl. And it's her fault that the cross was destroyed. And the cross isn't there because you're supposed to remember not to be like her. And you're supposed to remember what went wrong inside of the community. And then under that shadow, there's a murder. And there's a new dilemma that arises. Who did it? And there are multiple assumptions and claims, and they can't all be true, and somebody is lying. But interestingly, they're all of the same faith. And so it really makes you beg the question, who can we trust here? That's a good murder mystery, right? You, got you on your toes. Who can you trust? So after the movie, we discussed it, and we noted, those of us who were there, that the movie was pointing to real trends in our culture, real divisions that exist within churches and within our world. And it exposes ways that that people can talk themselves into backing something evil because they feel like it's the only way. And people can talk themselves into that. And we talked about all those themes. And it makes you think, when you watch a movie like that, that it would be nice if that was just the movies, right? But it's not. And even in our discussion, there were all the ways in which it sort of made us think, oh, these themes are so true. Even if they're a little bit blown out of proportion, they're so true. For me, and I hate to even bring up the dread words, the name, but as I was scrolling at some point late last week and this week, there was the picture of Dr. Fauci on trial. And my immediate thought was, oh no, right? And it was almost like this, like a bracing myself, like one might do if, you know, if you have PTSD from being off to war and you hear a sound that reminds you of something. It was a little like that because it was just a alert. And why did I feel that alert at just seeing the face of a guy on social media? Well, because it's the misinformation debate, right? And I have friends, family, church members on both sides of that bad boy, right? Some of them who, when they see the face of Dr. Fauci, they go, good guy. Some who, when they see the face of Dr. Fauci, say, bad guy. And I know what happened years ago around that issue and how much it damaged relationships. And I don't just know it from watching it. I know it from experiencing it. So just seeing his face made me go, ah, I don't want to do this. Like, how can I delete this from all social media on everybody's feed? So we don't do that again, right? That's what happened in my head. And it's the same with, you know, whatever the latest political event is, whatever the biggest overseas development is, the, you know, who, whatever your opinion is on why homelessness is on the rise, whatever your opinion is about why a bunch of the buildings on Broadway that were supposed to be done 3 years ago still aren't done, what your opinion is on why the church down the street is having problems, what your opinion is on why your friend's friend is getting a divorce, what your opinion is on why Salad and Go got bought out by Dutch Bros. Right? Don't you want to know what's going on and have the information? And then there's going to be the people that have the counter narrative, right? There's another story. It's different. And this stuff is going on all around us. So in wisdom literature this year, way back at the beginning of the year, someone asked about what to do about misinformation. Misinformation. So here we are. Is misinformation a modern problem? You know, so can we even go to the Bible? Wouldn't it be nice to go to the Bible answer book and say, Fauci, and open up the Bible answer book and it just says, he's both a good guy and a bad guy. Okay, now I know. Now I know. But we can't, right? Does this ancient wisdom literature even speak to a time of rampant information and misinformation? That availability and dissemination of information is crazy. What could the Proverbs have to say to our time, right? So in the Proverbs that we read, I chose them for this reason, but I felt like there was a theme in those Proverbs, and that theme was misinformation. And I just want to go through them and see why it was happening and see if any of it relates, see if this is just ancient or if it's still true. So, the first one, good old, an honest witness tells the truth, a false witness tells lies. Cause number one of misinformation in the Proverbs, people have a tendency to not tell the truth. And that's why you have to call witnesses in the first place, right? Once you're at a court case, even in the ancient world, once a judge had to call people together and call people from the community, it means that there is a question about what's true and that there's a question about whether someone or not is being honest. And a couple weeks ago, we talked about definitions of sin, and one of them was iniquity. And if you could go deep dive that and go back a couple weeks, but it's this inner twistedness that every person has. And I would go as far as to say this, that everybody, and I say this from experience, when the truth is going to expose something in me that I don't want to be exposed, when the truth is going to challenge something in me that I don't want to be challenged, when the truth is going to cause me pain that I don't want to feel, that in that situation, I think everybody feels the inner pull away from the truth, whether it's to directly lie about it, whether it's to tell the half-truth, or whether it's to hide, right? And every time we do that, we violate one of the core 10 commandments of our faith that says not to bear false witness. Every time. We lie when we directly deny the truth with its opposite. You know, somebody says, were you at Circle K at midnight? No. Right? Yeah, that's a lie. We lie when we don't bring up what's true. You know, where were you last night? At home. And inwardly, you're like, eventually. Right? We lie when we tell partial truths. Where were you last night? At the movies. Part of the time. You know, yeah. That's all ways around telling the truth. So, okay, there's that inner tendency, and it's in the Proverbs, it's all over the place. Immediately outside of the garden. I mean, the fall is due to trying to be, in a sense, dishonest to God or hiding the truth from one another. And then immediately after that, you know, Cain kills his brother. Am I my brother's keeper? I mean, it's all misinformation. Cause number two, Proverbs 14. People are immature. It says, only simpletons believe everything they're told. The prudent carefully consider their steps. The wise are cautious and avoid danger. Fools plunge ahead with reckless confidence. And simpletons here, by the way, is not like, you know, I don't know. I'm from the country originally. Country bumpkins. Do people still talk about those? That's, I don't know. That's probably my family. That's not what simpleton means. Doesn't mean the under-resourced or under-educated people. In fact, this text in Proverbs is not coming from the most educated people. That would have been the Egyptians and the Mesopotamians. The Hebrew people were a small nation. It doesn't mean that. The word simpleton is more like the word for immature. And the goal in Proverbs actually assumes to some degree that everybody is immature and that everybody is to become more prudent or mature. The goal is always to move from immature to mature. So how do you diagnose immaturity? Here, one of the diagnoses is this. They believe everything you hear. You believe everything you hear. On the far side of that is paranoia. I would not like you to go there. But, you know, imagine before social media, what that was like. That usually meant that somebody came to you and they said, hey, you know, I don't know. I'm going to pick on somebody here. Roland, you're in that's what you get for being in the front row. Somebody comes and says, Roland called me a booger, you know? And I go, oh, Roland, unbelievable, you know? And I think to myself, he would never say such a weird, silly, and terrible thing. But, well, you know, Peter said so, right? Since we're working our way down the front row. And I just, okay, Roland stinks, you know? That's what it took. Now we don't even need to hear from somebody, right? We get bombarded, potentially, if you're consuming any media at all, with all kinds of claims all day long. So the other is that you plunge forward in reckless confidence, meaning that once something feels right to you, you leap into it without doing your homework. So that's me going up to Roland and saying, unbelievable. I heard what you did. You stink, right? And Roland goes, what? Right? That's immature, it says. It's immature. It's immature to believe the first thing that you hear without examining it. It's immature to just act on that without investigation. That's immature. I wish I could say immaturity was eliminated by aging. But I worked in the independent living home when I was young, and we've talked about that. And I'm getting older slightly, and I'm not entirely maturing just because I hope I am. But, you know, I've seen that sometimes age can actually kind of lock one into immaturity. A modern proverb would be, you can't teach an old dog new tricks. And what's that talking about, right? People get set in their ways. They're not always mature, right? And I've seen younger people who've learned early how to respond with maturity to situations. So you can't just live and become mature. It's not that simple. You have to grow in wisdom. Now, remember, we're in ancient history right now. Has that all aged out? Or is that still the case? There's nothing new under the sun. To quote wisdom literature, there's nothing new under the sun, says Roland. Okay, cause number three, people think they're actually secrets. Proverbs 15:3 says, the Lord is watching everywhere, keeping his eye on both the good and the evil. You know, the old tradition still active in some courts where they bring the Bible out and a person puts one hand on the Bible and they raise the other, right? And the Bible one is active in some courts today, not in nearly as many. But the raising of the hand is still a thing. And I was looking that up. I was just curious. And it's old English common law. But even in English common law, the raising of the hand was an acknowledgement of God. So it was meant to be saying, here's my open hand, God. There's nothing hidden. That's what it was supposed to be. Now it's kind of just like, I don't know. I don't know what people think when they do that in court. When they stand before the judge, they're just like, hand up. I will tell the truth. Sure. You know? That's how it feels. But it used to be an acknowledgement of God, which, by the way, just for another fun fact, the reason people used to raise their hands in worship was the same. God, my heart is open before you. You see everything. Now people raise their hands in worship because they're like, I'm pumped, you know? And so somehow we've kind of lost the meaning of some of the things we do. Anyway, the hand, right? Hand up. Why was that built into the judicial system, right? It's this acknowledgement that God knows the truth. There are no secrets. And it was acknowledgement that God could do something about that. It was a belief that God could do something about that. And now today, I think the people, when people tell the truth, it's really just because the justice system might find the truth and they don't want to get caught lying and deal with the repercussions. But there's not this acknowledgement anymore that there are no secrets. Has that changed? Are there secrets now? Right? Is there no God who sees anymore? That's probably one of the ones we have to think about the most. I think, even for myself, this is a core question because I was not raised in a world that believed there were no secrets. I was raised in a world where even in the church, people thought you could keep secrets. I think we have to think about that. Cause number four, an impurity through the eagerness to hear gossip and slander. Proverbs 17, 3 through 4. Fire tests the purity of silver and gold, but the Lord tests the heart. There's that God knows thing. Wrongdoers eagerly listen to gossip. Liars pay close attention to slander. For the sake of time, I'll remind you that a couple weeks ago in the reconciliation sermon, we talked about the addictive nature of junk food. And on our very movie night, Taylor brought the platter, not just a bowl of candy, a charcuterie board of candy that she sat, and she looked right at me. She looked me dead in the eye and she said, this is for you, Andy, right? And something like that, wasn't it? And I thought, and I didn't say this, but I thought, I talked about how I eat too many carrots. Where's my carrot platter? You know, the healthy platter. But no, Taylor brought, and it was an incredible spread of candy, and I loved it. But the point was, we talked about how it's so easy to indulge in gossip. It's like the bowl of candy that you just thoughtlessly pop in your mouth, and it's not good for you. And you'd eat way more candy than you would ever talk yourself into at the store. But when it's just in a bowl in front of you, oh, it's just so easy. And the same is true of gossip and slander. It's just so alluring and easy to do. It's addictive. So the proverb begs the question, with that in mind, do you indulge in gossip and slander because you're a wrongdoer? Or do you end up becoming a wrongdoer because you engage in gossip and slander? That would be a wisdom literature discussion. Like a chicken and egg, right? But wisdom that calls out to us, I think, says, how about you get out of it either way? If you might be a wrongdoer and that's why you engage in gossip, you could stop being a wrongdoer and do right. If that gossip and slander is going to corrupt you, you could avoid that by renouncing that and saying, I'm not doing that anymore, right? That would be wise. Cause number five, we don't know where we are safe. Proverbs 18, 10 to 13 says, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The godly run to it and are safe. The rich think of their wealth as a strong defense. They imagine it to be a high wall of safety. Haughtiness goes before destruction. Humility precedes honor. Spouting off before listening to the facts is both shameful and foolish. It's a comparison. This proverb is a comparison between perceived safety and actual safety. I grew up in religious circles, and there was a way of talking about everybody else. And it was the term worldly. Have you ever heard that? Worldly. And so I want us to look at this proverb using that idea of worldly. What is worldly here? Worldly is to believe that wealth is actually safer than poverty. Worldly is to believe that haughtiness or an arrogant presentation of the self is better than humility. Worldly is to believe that spouting off and talking is better than listening. Rod once shared an article with the breakfast group, those of us who get breakfast with Rod. If you've met Rod, he was the big guy with the deep voice that preached from the big stool. He shared an article that just was, it was like a, they'd done some study. If a quiet person is teaching you or a talkative person, which one do you believe? Which one do you think they believe? The talker. Every time. And people will say that talkativeness doesn't mean wisdom. But at the end of the day, if you took a jury, right, and you put them in the room to deliberate, and one juror talks the whole time, most people will follow them. Interesting. Is that wise? Probably not. So what if we defined worldliness as this, as believing we're most safe and secure when we have money and things and when we have confident-looking and confident-sounding people leading us? Then I ask you, are we less worldly than our culture? There's a lot of that going on in my heart, in our little world of the church. There's a lot of talk in our culture about being safe, and I think our culture and the church are very similar, because I think safe in our culture also means find your tribe and its confident leaders, make sure you have the money and the resources on your side, and that will alleviate the anxiety that you feel. But the wisdom of the Proverbs says all of that is actually making you more susceptible to destruction. It's a false safety. The strong fortress is to run to what it says, what it calls the name of the Lord. Now, I'm not demeaning that financial responsibility is good. I'm not demeaning the idea that leadership should have some form of confidence or should speak for things. But I am saying that this proverb seems to say that those are not ultimate things and they can easily crumble. Rod, again, at breakfast this week, talked about being in the hospital and that he started thinking about dying. He's been in the hospital several times this year, and when you're going back multiple times, you start to think, this is going the wrong direction. And he talked about how he'd always thought that his plan or his savings account or some form of, you know, his, like, the government setup that he had to protect him was pretty secure. But then when you start thinking my body could stop working, you realize none of that can save me. And it's a good thing to remember. If there's a God who can bring safety even amidst the chaos of death, wouldn't that be what we need most amidst the chaos of life? We think we know what keeps us safe. Cause number 6, we rush to conclusions. Proverbs 18:17 says, the first to speak in court sounds right until the cross-examination begins. That's true. Been there. Proverbs 19:2 says, enthusiasm without knowledge is no good. Haste makes mistakes. That's a great English translation, by the way, right? Memorable. Haste makes mistakes. I guarantee you it didn't sound like that in Hebrew, but I applaud that. That was a good job. It's true, right? It's not hard to present a compelling case. It's hard, though, to establish a case against an argument. If you want to be hasty and get a quick answer, you are very liable to get that wrong. You know, can you imagine how much harder it was to get a quick answer in ancient times and how stacked the decks are against us today? Ninja and I were car shopping the other day. And to my great surprise, when I picked him up, he had data on this vehicle and all the things that could go wrong all on his phone. I know this guy's never bought a car before. You know, and it's like he has so much information that he can get really, really quick. In fact, the fuel door didn't open. And guess what? YouTube, Ninja figured it out, solved his problem, right? How easily we can get information. If it felt like they needed wisdom back then, right? To not rush to conclusions. How much more do we need to exercise wisdom to not rush to conclusions when we think we can find an answer in 30 seconds? Probably we need it more. Cause number 7 from the Proverbs. We like to blame God for our mistakes, it says. People ruin their lives by their own foolishness and they get angry at God. I actually didn't remember this proverb until this week. I've probably been avoiding it, if I'm honest, right? I probably, every time my eyes saw it, I just went, let's move on. I just went, that's in there. That's so true. Religious types, we like to point at the world, right, as the problem, the reason there's misinformation, right? Because people don't know the truth in the world. That happens in religious circles. But this proverb is speaking to a culture that was pre-secular, in which I mean this, the idea of atheism or agnosticism would have had you laughed out of town when the proverbs were written. Literally, people would have just been like, no deity? You idiot. You would have been a fool. Early Christians, in fact, were called atheists. Did you know that? Because their God was so, like, disembodied to them. Like, you couldn't find it in a temple. So they actually were like, that's atheism. That's how pre-secular this world was, okay? And even in a very, very religious culture, people were fooled and believed lies and blamed God. And it happens in our circles too. It's not just unbelievers that are causing our problems. Believers cause their own problems, is my point. How so? Okay. If you came up in Christian faith, as I did, we come up with really complex and theological arguments to get angry at God. And sometimes we don't even call it that. Here would be a classic. Here's a classic. This is if you're Reformed, okay? So there's a subset of you that are like, that's not me. Great, you get off the hook on this one. If you feel Reformed and you do something wrong and you say to yourself, well, God knows all. He predestines all things. So I was always going to do that. Right? And in some weird, twisted way, you can go like, what choice did I have? Kind of God's fault for predestining me this way. Right? I've heard that argument. Okay. Yeah, that's one way of doing it. Or here's the other way we religious people do it. You say, I feel like I pray and I pray and I pray and I'm asking God for things, and God doesn't give it to me. I do not trust God anymore. And so I'm angry at God, right? And I felt that. Do you know what I was doing when I felt that? I was saying that by talking at God, I was trusting God. But what I meant by trust was not that I would submit to God's will, but that I would approve of God's decision when it lined up with what I was asking for. Kind of like God was an employee of mine that would get paid back by me once he did what I asked him to do. How not, you know, I have reversed myself and God in the equation. Who rules? Right? For those who are newer to faith, I have far more compassion for you than I have on myself because it's new. But this is, I think, how it often goes. And I've done this, by the way. I think a lot of times when you're newer to faith, you come to God with a solution you want. You want a problem solved. And that's normal. For me, when I was 17, I had heard about, you know, God my whole life, but I would say I hadn't really leaned in. But the starting point, the instigating circumstance was a depression, a deep depression. and I really just didn't want to live, is how I felt. And that led me to try trusting Jesus. And I felt way better, and I liked that. And I assumed this would last the rest of my life because I had been saved. And it lasted quite a while, and then the deep darkness came back. And I wasn't really happy about that, right? Like, I trusted you, God. This is why I came to you, was to get this fixed. How could it be back? Essentially saying to God, I trust you when you're giving me what I want. What if, though, and I think this was what I learned, that growth in faith might mean that God has made me able to face the darkness in the world, the chaos in the world, in a way I wasn't able to before, and a knowledge that God is with me in the middle of it, which I didn't have before. What if that is actually what I need, more than just to be free from circumstances? Now, what does that have to do with misinformation? Well, when we stop trusting God and we get angry at God, our default can be to trust in all the other things we trusted in, defending ourselves, hiding the truth, being on our own. A culture in or out of the church that blames God will excuse the very things that pit people against each other and break trust because there's no God that I'm accountable to, or I'm angry at God. I'll do what I want. And we break community and we make things worse. The eighth cause, we don't move toward each other with a desire to understand. Proverbs 25 said, good advice lies deep in the heart. A person with understanding will draw it out. And a desire to know what's deep within another person requires a deep trust that God knows and cares for me, so I actually can pursue another person. I don't have to just guard myself. So that was a lot. I'm going to name them real fast one more time. The causes of misinformation, our inner aversion to the truth, our iniquity, our immaturity, our illusion that we can actually have secrets, our impurity that leads to keep us engaging in gossip and slander, our illusion that we can actually be safe, our impatience for an answer we like, our propensity to blame God for our mistakes, and our aversion to draw deeply from other people. And you can layer right onto that the ubiquitous use of social media, all the pieces of information that's everywhere all at once, fewer binding beliefs or institutions, and all the decks seem like they are stacked against us, right? What an encouraging sermon. Let's eat beef. It is going to be a delicious dinner tonight. But while the Proverbs exhibit all that misinformation and how it comes to us in all these various ways, it mercifully shows us that the way out is much more simple, much more simple. And it is not escaping misinformation. It is not fixing the problem in the world. That is not going to help you. What is it? 18:10, we already read this. The name of the Lord is a strong fortress. The godly run to him and are safe. Proverbs 15:3, the Lord is watching everywhere, keeping his eye on both the evil and the good. 19:5, a false witness will not go unpunished, nor will a liar escape. And that's the inferences, because God is watching. Proverbs 25:2, it is God's privilege to conceal things and the king's privilege to discover them. Kevin, in our sermon review meeting, said something really good, and I don't even get to embarrass him with it today because he isn't here. No. Kevin said this. It seems, and by the way, Kevin is one of those guys that says about one thing per meeting. And as, you know, the talker, I should probably tell you, listen to Kevin. It seems that in our overthinking, we can have the delusion of being able to figure it all out. And that's what keeps us from sitting at Jesus' feet. 10 points for Kevin. And I've been thinking about that, and I realized something. I realized that when I think of sitting at Jesus' feet, I assume something like it's some sort of really pious religious act, like a really focused prayer, and I'm bad at those. So like, I tend to envision that in order to sit at Jesus' feet, I actually have to enter into kind of some Zen-like prayer state. And the pictures are always the Martha and Mary pictures, and so I always like feel like men don't do that. That's just for girls, which probably isn't true. And I really do think like to sit at Jesus' feet, I would just be like, Jesus. And just sit there real quiet. And I'm just admitting that because it sounds weird, but I think maybe that's how we all feel. It's just like, it doesn't seem like something you could actually do. But I thought, what if I use these proverbs to think about what it could mean? Like, what if I viewed myself as running into a fortress and that there's a king in that fortress who's actually my creator, who sent his son into the world to save me, who actually was strong enough to protect me no matter what warfare might be assailing me or what enemy might be pursuing me, whether it's criticism, lies, chaos in the world, chaos in my mind, sickness, death, that if I ran and I sat under his feet, that I could actually be safe? Like, what if I imagine, what if that is true? I mean, isn't that what it means? Like, the name of the Lord is a strong tower. The righteous run to him and they are safe. It doesn't just mean Zen-like state. It means I'm scared, the world's crazy, and I'm going to sit under you and trust that you actually know what you're doing here. And that's tough for me to do. But I think I might need to do that. And then I thought, what if I imagined sitting with him as a blind and deaf person? Utterly blind, I can't see. Utterly deaf, I can't hear. So therefore, I cannot see what people are doing, and I can't discern their motives. I can't hear what they're saying about me or anything else in the world. But the one who I sit with can see and hear everything. And that he is guiding me through a life that I cannot comprehend. What if that were true? What if I realized that there's an honor of being in relationship to God and part of his kingdom? That to sit at his feet would be like being his child. That I could inquire into what God knows and seek to understand God's ways. And that by giving God my attention, I could not understand the world, but understand the privilege of having such access to the one who does understand the world. I thought of a psalm that when I was on the silent retreat a few weeks ago, one of the other leaders memorized this psalm. It's a short one. He's my kind of guy. I like to memorize short things. But Psalm 131, Lord, my heart is not proud. My eyes are not haughty. Doesn't that remind you of Proverbs 18, what we are supposed to renounce? I don't concern myself with matters too great or too awesome for me to grasp. Such as, what is another person's motive? Or what did some politician actually mean? Or, you know, when will nuclear war destroy us all? I don't concern myself with matters too great or too awesome for me to grasp. Instead, I have calmed and quieted myself like a weaned child who no longer cries for its mother's milk. Some of you ladies in the room know that. What that means. Yes, like a weaned child is my soul within me. O Israel, put your hope in the Lord now and always. So what could that look like? One of the most striking features of the movie we watched, Knives Out, is what begins to happen inside one of the main characters, Father Judd. So at this point, toward the end of the film, he's been accused of the murder. And he's actually, due to some circumstances, beginning to wonder if he actually is guilty of murder. He's not even sure. And there's a scene where some evidence comes up that could clear his name and break the case wide open. And he just needs an answer on the phone. He needs an answer. He needs to know who called in the order. And he's trying to get through to the lady, but she is talkative. And she's chatty. And then she's crying. And as any man knows, when there's a woman on the other side of a phone crying and you're trying to solve a problem, this is a really difficult situation and you want to run and throw the phone, okay? And that's about where he's at. And in the midst of that, she asks him to pray for her. And Judd realizes he remembers who he is. He remembers that it's most important to carry her to the feet of Jesus. More important than solving a case, more important than clearing his own name, more important than figuring out what wicked people were up to. So much so that after his prayer, the detective is like asking him and saying, "We're about to break this case open." And he finally looks at him and says, "I don't care." And everybody watching the movie goes, "Finally. But what about us? Do we not care anymore because we know what to care about more?" I can imagine in a community like us getting to the place where we look around at the constant flood of things to concern ourselves with online, between people, the slander, the news, what Trump said, what Fauci really did, my uncle's hot take on all of it, whose fault our local issues are, what other people think of us as a church or you individually, and decide, "I don't care. Not much. Because I can sit at the feet of Jesus. And that is what is most important. And I can bring other people in prayer or in person to the feet of Jesus." And look, all the people who come to the feet of Jesus will have their own opinions. They won't all agree. We'll get caught in misinformation sometimes. The Major League Baseball trade deadline was just the other day, and I texted Johnny that the Cubs got Reed Detmers. False report. They didn't. I get caught in it too. It happens. It's easy to do. Who cares? It's not that important. It's not nearly as important as trusting in Jesus. Imagine if we could look at other people, not as their judge, but from the place of sitting at the feet of Jesus, trusting God with them, that he discerns what is good and what is evil, that he will finish the story. Not only would you find more peace, I think like Father Judd in this movie, you would find that you're actually available to minister to people again. And that's what we're supposed to do. And the more we truly minister to people, the more truth they will see, and the more truth they will tell, and the more evil they will renounce. And guess what? If there's any hope we have to deal with the misinformation battle, it's going to be from getting people to run to Jesus as their strong tower. That's where it's going to happen. The strong tower isn't on either side of the information wars. It's in the name of the Lord our God. I don't want to spoil this film, but I will say in the final scenes, there's a character who is hell-bent, and I mean that, hell-bent, on getting wealthy in order to become influential. And he wants a treasure that's been hidden somewhere in the church for decades, and Judd the priest tells him, "Your real inheritance is in Christ," and he is furious, and he peels out and he drives away. But what Judd has discovered is that all the lies and the killing and the cover-ups have been motivated by something other than Jesus. So Judd builds a new cross for the sanctuary. And he hides something in it. Something that people think they all need. But he's discovered that what they need is hidden in Christ. What they need is what had changed him from being full of hate to being full of grace. And when we think of how Jesus came to save us, we need to remember that Jesus endured being maligned. His critics bore false witness against him. His followers turned on him. His disciples doubted him. Think of somebody who was affected by misinformation. I mean, Jesus, he endured it. And he entrusted himself to his Father. He ran to his Father. His Father did not make his life easier, right? But rather, he called Jesus to trust in his power to raise him from the dead, which is what seems painful and impossible, you know, death on a cross. But Jesus brought all who would trust in him to the feet of his Father to be reconciled to their Maker, and he ministers to us all. He brings us to the strong tower where we are actually safe. We'll move now into our final three rhythms of worship, which are confess, receive, and offer. In confession, we take 2 minutes of silence. Today, I want to encourage you in that 2 minutes of silence to think, what is it that I think keeps me safe? And if you could come up with a word or an image, what would it look like for you to sit at Jesus' feet? And allow yourself to really think about what that could be like for you. After confession, we practice receiving. There are many ways we receive from God. We receive everything from God. Every good and perfect gift comes from our God. But we come to the table where Jesus broke bread and said, "This is my body broken for you. Every time you eat of this, remember me." And where he took the cup, the wine from the table, and said, "This is the blood of my new covenant, of the forgiveness of many. Every time you drink of it, remember me." And we receive what he has done for us, and we remember that when we run to the feet of Jesus, when we run to his cross, we get what we actually need in a confusing and chaotic world. He moved through the chaos so that we can know that at the end of the chaos, there's safety, and we can trust in him. And then offer. As you walk away from the table, we kind of come down this aisle and go around the front. There's a table back in the very back where we take monetary gifts, which are very important as a way of saying, "I trust in you, God." But also, we have that glass window back there. And I want to take that word that you think of what it would mean for you to sit at the feet of Jesus and write that on that window. Just as a way of kind of remembering and memorializing what it would look like to trust in him. So think about that for you. What would it look like running to a king who is actually in control? Would it look like being blind and deaf and just believing that God could see and know everything that you cannot? Would it look like becoming like a child and trusting that he is there and knows and has your best interests in mind? Or is there another way that would work for you? Write it back there to help you remember. I'm going to pray for us and leave 2 minutes of silence for you of confession. And then Mike will come forward and start leading music when the table will be open. Let's pray. Father, there's a lot of mess to navigate in our world. It's not just in the world out there, it's in here. It's not just in the other people in here, it's in me. All of that junk that leads to misinformation is proceeding from our hearts. And we need you. We need your grace, we need your mercy, we need your help, we need your promises. We need your cross. So guide us there and help us to be honest with you, knowing that when we confess to you, you're faithful and just to forgive us and to cleanse us of all unrighteousness. So lead us now as we pray.